I dedicate this talk to the welfare of all beings. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I only allocated 25 minutes for this talk, and usually when I talk, it seems like I talk quite a bit longer than that. So I get to practice that discipline this morning of keeping things brief. I brought up at Sangha a couple of weeks ago, I brought up this case from the Book of Serenity, this story from the Book of Serenity about, it's called Yunyan's Great Compassion. And I think some of you were there for that, but probably most of you were not there for that presentation. So I'll just briefly recount that this is a case in which Yunyan asks a monk named Dao Wu, who was his Dharma brother. It's not like his teacher. They're Dharma brothers, Yunyan and Dao Wu. So they have a lot of fun together, testing each other vis-a-vis their understanding of the Dharma. So Yunyan asked Dao Wu, in this case, he says, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? So you know that the Bodhisattva of compassion is often shown in a statue as having all these different arms, and sometimes in each hand of the arm there's a tool or some vajra something or other, some dharma symbol. So the question is, why does the Bodhisattva, or what does the Bodhisattva do, the Bodhisattva compassion do with so many hands and eyes? And Dao Wu says, it's like someone reaching back for a pillow at night. So, you know, like a lot of these cases, the so-called answer merely extends the question. You know, it extends the question out further. It makes us question, what does the so-called answer have to do with the question at all? But of course, in the answer, there is a hand reaching back for the pillow, we assume. So it must have something to do with the hand. The case goes on. The Yunyan says, I understand. And Dao Wu says, how do you understand? All over the body are hands and eyes. And Dao Wu says, you've said a lot there, but it's only about 80%. What about you, elder brother? Yunyan says, throughout the body, hands and eyes. Throughout the body, hands and eyes. So what I suggested when we were discussing this before is that this case is talking about the active principle of compassion, that there is a force, isn't, but maybe force like they, a force like they use it in Star Wars, the force. There's a force. There's this, and because in Star Wars, the force is, you tap into it, and then you are aligned with the good. Actually, you know, you're on the good guy's side in Star Wars if you tap into the force. If you are one with the force, so we can use that example. So I submitted that this case is about the active principle, the active force of compassion in the sense of Star Wars force, of compassion in our world. And there is a poem that goes along, as every case in the Book of Serenity has a poem that's composed by Hongjer. And I thought that these lines of the poem were particularly illustrative of this idea of that this case is about the principle of compassion pervading, the pervading principle of compassion. So these two lines, I won't read the whole poem, but these two lines are, I think, very clear. Formless, selflessly, spring enters the pipes. Unstopped, unhindered, the moon traverses the sky. So this gives us this image of this, you know, unstopped force, you know, this principle that's just moving through the sky and hopefully, you know, moving through our lives in an unhindered way, that there is this unhindered orbit of compassion around our lives, and it's like spring entering the pipes. It's like the flowers blooming on the trees outside now. You know, it's just unstopped. It is bursting forth from its own inner being. So, you know, this is the active. That's what I submit is the active principle of compassion. That we have faith in, we put our faith in our practice. So, you know, as oftentimes I do, after I give some kind of presentation in the Sangha, I think about, well, did I cover everything? Did I really talk about everything that I should have talked about, or did I give a complete picture? And in this case, I thought, no, I hadn't. And so that's why I'm bringing it up again, because I think that even though we can say and we can have these kind of lofty presentations, poetic presentations of this principle of compassion, this force of compassion, and we can imagine that, and actually imagining that, you know, and putting our trust and faith in that is uplifting, and it's an important part of our practice. And there's the active principle, and there's also the practice, the active practice of compassion. There's the active of intention and enjoining in with that active principle. And so I think it's important for us to study these active practices of compassion, as well as, you know, and as an important outcome or further extension of our faith in the principle of compassion. That's why. So I said in the last period I spoke of the opening lines of the Metta Sutta. This is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches, and so on. Let one be wise but not puffed up. Let one do nothing that is mean or that the wise would reprove. So I thought it's interesting and important that the Metta Sutta, it asks something of the practitioner at the beginning, And there's so the opening lines are kind of like, if you want to practice this compassion, this loving kindness, you kind of need to look at yourself first, and there's kind of some purification that you need to do. You need to check out yourself first. So these opening lines are like this purification before you can say, "May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and free from suffering." There's these preparatory practices before you can undertake, and you're looking at your own motivation, your own where you're coming from. So to me this is kind of this active practice of compassion that's illustrated at the beginning of the Metta Sutta. When I spoke of it at Sangha, I talked about this incident, this event, where I handed someone whose hands were cold. I was holding a cup of tea, and their hands were cold, and I saw that because they were trying to warm their hands on this stove, and so I just handed the person my cup of tea, which was warm, I spoke about that as kind of like a manifestation of the principle of compassion, because I didn't really do it. I mean, it was just my hands just went over there, you know, like reaching back for a pillow at night. The hands just went over there and gave the cup of tea, so the person could have that warmth. So that's one side, and that's I'd say on the side of the principle. It's the principle, you know. At that time, I was deeply immersed in formal practice and doing a lot of zazen, and when you're doing that, that kind of practice, I don't know, it's like the membrane or something. The membrane that separates you and others gets really, really thin. Gets really, really thin, and you have, you know, your natural sympathies for the difficulties or sufferings of others come right to the surface, you know, and it just flows a little bit out of you, you know, it flows out of you because the boundary, that's the word I was looking for, the boundary between self and other gets, you know, really thin. It gets a lot thinner when you're doing that kind of practice. So then you feel like, oh well, I'm with the principle of compassion, and of course it's wonderful to practice like that, and it's wonderful to have that kind of event. But you know, day to day life, you know, it's maybe not always so much like that. So what I'm saying is that we can then to complement this, or the other side of this is this active practice of meditation, where we really, of compassion, this active practice of compassion, where we really take on intentional practices, or we're really thinking about the practice of compassion as we go about our daily life. So those practices are spoken about in various ways, but one of the most mainstream ways of talking about them in the Mahayana tradition is the six perfections. The six perfections are the most mainstream practices of compassion. So, and especially I don't know. I shouldn't say especially. But let's, I probably only talk about the first three, so I'll just talk about the first three briefly. So the first three perfections are the perfection of generosity, the perfection of morality or ethics, and the perfection of patience. Those are the first three, and those are all practices of compassion that we can intentionally take on. So it's really, you know, just to say a few things about generosity. I thought there was a really good example this morning. I asked Alan, this is Alan, everybody. Not everybody knows Alan, but most everybody else knows everybody else here. This is Alan. Anyway, Alan came early, and I asked him if he would sweep the walk, because the walk was covered with, like, buds or something. They were coming off the trees, right? And it was pretty messy. And so Alan kindly took the broom and swept the walk. And then later on, I heard somebody say, coming up, say, "Oh, the place looks really clean. You know, it looks like they've really been keeping things up around here." And I thought, well, it wouldn't have looked that way if Alan hadn't taken the broom and swept the walk. You know, people might have come up and said, "Wow, they really need to do more around this place. It's kind of a mess." So, you know, this is, you know, just a little bit of giving, you know, has a big impact, a big effect on how people think about what's going on, what's happening. And I would submit that as a practice, we can really take on, oh, like I have like 4 minutes left. Okay. We can take on giving as we can take on giving as a way worth thinking about what we're doing. So I would submit that, like, you can, if you think about what you're doing as giving, then almost everything you're doing can be thought of as giving. And if you're doing something and you can't think of it as giving, I think you should question what you're doing. You should question whether this is really what you want to be doing, or what, yeah, is this what I want to be doing? Because it's really hard for me to think of it as giving. You know, it's really, really difficult for me to think of it as giving. But you know, so that's one thing. But the other thing is to take, you know, every, you know, to try to understand the very routine aspects of your life. Like, you make dinner, right? So you make dinner for yourself, or you make dinner for yourself and some other people. And I need to listen to my own teaching here, because, you know, I'm not an enthusiastic cook these days. I don't really like to really cook that much. So if I'm not making dinner and thinking of it as well, I'm giving something to myself, or I'm giving something to the other persons who are going to eat with me. Well, anyway, we can try to transform our motivation. How could I think about this differently? How could I align myself? And this goes back maybe to the principle of compassion, the principle of generosity. How can I align myself with giving? And maybe we can't, but it's something. It's an invitation that's always there to see our activity as a gift. And also, of course, if we bring wisdom into it, from the wisdom side, then there's three things that we're not supposed to see when we're doing it. We're not supposed to see a giver. We're not supposed to see somebody who's given to, and we're not supposed to see a gift, right? So this is the emptiness of the emptiness side of giving. So at that point we just think, well, it's just like the moon traversing the sky. It just does. It's orbiting. It can't help it. It's gravity. It's caught in the Earth's gravity. May I be like that? We could say that. I think it'd be okay to say that. May I be like the moon orbiting the Earth? And maybe you can't, but you could still kind of, please let me be. Please let me be like that. And I think it's it could be helpful. You can't use it as a thing to sort of compare yourself to. That wouldn't be right. You can't continually compare yourself to some ideal of giving, and because that might result in you thinking about how you're falling short all the time. So it's better just to keep in mind that, well, it's a possibility that I could see at least 10% of my motivation in this moment as coming from giving. Maybe 90% of it is just, I don't want to be doing this. I just really don't want to be cooking dinner, and I'd rather be anywhere else than doing this. But maybe there's 10% of you that can think, well, I think that, somebody, even myself, would enjoy eating this when it's done and find it nutritious, and it would make the rest of my day or evening or go better if this was prepared well and it was also prepared as a gift, as something we were just offering. So we have to be careful not to use these practices as a cudgel of any kind to compare ourselves to and then see how we fall short. That's certainly not the point. But generosity is a very deep practice. I'm going over now, but I'll say one more thing about generosity because it's a point that my teacher is always bringing up, and I think it's so important. And that is that he includes the idea of kind of host and guest in generosity. So, like when a guest comes, what the host welcomes the guest. I mean, the job of the host is to welcome the guest. The job of the host is to be giving and welcoming. Giving in that sense is like the same as welcoming. Okay, so to be welcoming whatever comes. So this is another part of generosity is welcoming what comes, and not shutting the door on it. So this applies to, if I'm cooking dinner and I don't want to be, and I have negative feelings about my activity, then I welcome that. I welcome, okay, I see you're here. I see this negativity part is here. I welcome it. I acknowledge it. I don't necessarily encourage it. I didn't ask it to come to the door, but there it is, and I'm okay. The fact that it's here, I'm going to now be easeful with that. I'm not going to encourage it. I'm not going to sit down to tea with it. I'm not going to wallow in it. That's a favorite word Reb likes to use. Don't wallow in it. But we don't do things like say, oh, I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't be, you know, or we should, well, if we're like that, then we see we're like that. But anyway, that you get the idea. The idea is just to welcome what comes and to not, because, you know, the moon traversing the sky is, you know, welcoming every bit of space that it goes through. You know, it doesn't say, this bit of space that I'm going through is not, or this phase that I'm going through, this phase, this half moon, I hate being the half moon. It's really a drag. I love being the quarter moon. And whoa, when I'm the full moon, I'm really, really happy. The moon doesn't do that, you know. So, you know, to be unhindered is the task of a whole lifetime, you know, to have that kind of feeling about your life. So I have to quit, and so we can sit more, and I'm happy to quit now.